heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation.
The nation.
And now, Malcolm.
The biggest story, people, is that the news is not reporting these stories. So it's real hard, if you've got an ignorant public, to make change and to understand what's happening. My goal here on The Voice of a Nation is to change that and to bring the voices and real intelligence to the airwaves for you to hear and to digest. But in order to do that, friends, I need to ask you to also invite your friends. And I want you to invite not just your Republican friends, but your Democrat friends. And clearly you have them. And I want to tell you that right up front here. Invite your Democrats and your moderates and people that are left of the aisle and let them hear some of the information here, please, on The Voice of a Nation. It's very important we get this information out. Our goal at the end of the day is to bridge the gap and to advance humanity, bar none. And so with that, I want to talk today to you about dealing with rogue governments here in a longer program in conversation with three extraordinary voices here. It's more than just Iran. It's more than just North Korea. It's more than just Syria. It's more than just the terrorist states or the ISIS. And, you know, it's a lot of areas. It's also a lot of countries in Africa that people are not paying attention to. And there's a lot of jihadists in Africa, quite frankly. And there's a lot happening with those countries that people are not focused on. And in fact, a lot of that comes into other areas where we talk about our migration problem on the southern border. Part of the problem of that, folks, is many of those people are coming in from Africa. And there's a lot of suspicious characters, let's say, coming across into our country. This should have everybody most concerned because the danger is real. And, you know, when you're dealing with rogue governments, we're also can expand that to say dealing with rogue enterprises like these terrorist groups, these organizations that have one motive, they want to do away with the West. They want power and they want death to America. And so, listen, there's a lot to talk about here. IQ Al Razzouli is here. He is author of Lifting the Veil. It's a trilogy now. You can get on Amazon or the America Out Loud bookstore. IQ was born in Baghdad, actually. He was born right there. I mean, he understands the culture. He can talk about world affairs, but he is certainly one of the foremost authorities in the world on the subjects of Islam and many of the factors that we're dealing with when we talk about rogue governments. Also joining us here is Baruch Plettner, and Baruch is an entrepreneur, he's a scientist, an inventor, but he's passionate about the war on globalism. He writes, he's a fabulous columnist, as actually Ilana IQ and Baruch all are. He's the editor-in-chief of Zionism.com, and he's a wonderful voice and man to have with us here today. Ilana Friedman is just a thrill and a great voice here at America Out Loud. We love Ilana, as you know, and she's a veteran intelligence analyst, a political commentator and host here at America Out Loud is her home. And she's an author. Her newest book, Hamas, The Story of Islamic Jihad on Israel's Front Lines, is a must read. She's got a series of books, actually, and you can get those, friends, on America Out Loud bookstore and on Amazon. So you can get those links right at AmericaOutLoud.com. We invite you in there. In a recent news story here that I have not seen really any coverage on, it was in regards to Iran. They arrested 17 people accused of being CIA-trained spies. This is really plays into, again, a standoff that they're having with America, clearly. Now they've handed down death sentences to some of these people here. And they're saying that they're part of the CIA-trained spy network. Baruch, what do you make of this story? What do you think about this?
I think it's just this continuation of pre-positioning for armed conflict that everybody knows is coming, though nobody wants it. I think Trump doesn't want it. And I think even Tehran, you know, the mullahs there don't want it either because they're scared of what Trump may do and how much he's going to deploy America's military might, which is overwhelming, to crush them. So what we see now is a lot of kind of maneuvering, pre-positioning of forces, that kind of stuff. And that is part of it. Another part is Hamas, you know, the Iran talked to them, and basically Hamas agreed, even though I thought they've always agreed, but now they kind of reaffirmed, I guess, their commitment to be Iran's proxy. And together with Hezbollah form a kind of a tri-patriot coalition in which for sure Israel would be hit first before anything else happens. So I think right now that's what's happening. Everybody's kind of jockeying for position. Everybody's maneuvering. Everybody's placing their forces in such a way that something goes off and boom, we're off to the races. They have the best possible position. You can see it in wrestling matches, in fact, like before they actually grapple, they kind of try to improve them. And that's, I think, what is happening there with respect.
Let me follow up a point with you on something here, Baruch, before we move on. And that is that you mentioned the mullahs not even wanting war. Now, let me say something to that, please. Now, obviously, one of the things that make this a more challenging situation is that typically these people live to die. And I say that all the time. I mean, that's their game plan is to get to Allah. And so they're not afraid to take, which is why you get a lot of these rogue bombers and these people that with backpacks on and things that go into cafes and public venues and have no problem with taking themselves out because they think they're going to a better place. My question is this, but I think the mullahs, as you just point out, are not stupid. Even though they're not afraid to die, you're saying that they know that they're outweighed heavily with American military might, and that's the real deterrent in the room here. But at the same time, I think people should realize that these people don't value life, correct?
Well, I think that, first of all, the first lives they don't value is yours and mine. You know, as far as we are concerned, you know, they definitely, you know, see us gone with no problem whatsoever. Mm-hmm. When it comes to their own lives, I think the equation is a little different. A typical, you know, like Iranian fisherman on the shores of the Persian Gulf, mm-hmm. all they want to do is catch fish and have a nice family and a nice life. And certainly they want to preserve their life. But when it comes to the mullahs, when it comes to the Revolutionary Guards, they have a different calculation. Because if they lose power, if they lose this battle, they're going to be killed by their own people. They committed atrocities that are so unspeakable against their own population. So they are kind of with their backs to the wall. Trump is trying to give them this choice, this out of staying in power, but giving up on their dreams of regional hegemony and doing away with Israel and all of that. But I think it's a kind of a false choice because they're so committed to this course of obtaining this hegemony, of bringing their Messiah, the Mahdi, and so on. They sold this story to their own people. They asked for such tremendous sacrifice from their own people, mm-hmm. to bring that end about, that if they don't accomplish it, I think their lives are forfeit. So I think they would rather die trying to accomplish those ends that they really do believe in than be torn limb from limb by their own population because they failed.
All right, let's bring in now IQ to something you just said. When you say that they're willing to, they've convinced their own people. You talk about propaganda. They're the kings of propaganda and what they've done to their own people. So they've convinced their own people. IQ, talk about that just a moment, please. Let's tell everybody here because, you know, you have a couple of forces here, IQ. You have the Iranian people, which are people like all people, and then you've got this belief system they've pushed onto the people. Talk about that, please, what Baruch says there.
Before 1979 and the collapse of the Shah's government and Khomeini taking over. By the way, Khomeini promised them to have a fair elections, and he betrayed the Iranian people. He massacred the opposition. So for 40 years, every single Iranian up to the age of 40 today has never known anything but Islamic Sharia, which is oppressive. They lied to them. I'm talking about the Iranian people. There is a huge opposition in Iran by the public. By the way, there are tens of thousands of Iranians who are converting to Christianity in Iran under the nose of the Ayatollahs. And the 17 people that are accusing or spying, you've got to understand something, Americans. You live in a democracy, a Republican democracy. But in Iran, they have no rule of law. Islam has no rule of law. They speak about Sharia. Sharia has no morals, no justice, nothing, zero. Mm-hmm. So when they accuse somebody of blasphemy or insulting Islam or insulting Muhammad or being a spy, this is all bullcrap. It's all red herring. They are meaningless. They are murdering. They don't execute anybody in Iran. They murder people. Mm-hmm. You execute after a trial, a justice trial or a justice trial, and you find the person convicted of murder or mass murder or whatever, then you execute.
Yeah.
In Islam, you murder people for whatever reason. Baruch is right, 100%.
You know, IQ, to your point, as an example to people, if you or I or Baruch or Ilana were having a conversation like this in the town square in Iran, we would be subject to be, in these kinds of conversations, we would be subject to be executed, would we not?
Executed, we would be slaughtered. Forget about it.
Exactly.
We would be cut to ribbons. Mm-hmm. Cut to ribbons. We're not discussing. You see, we're talking about cultural background. There is no such thing as a culture in Islam except death. Listen to them. They shout in public, the mullahs and the ayatollahs and the imams, we Muslims love death while you, kuffar, love life. Mm-hmm. How can you communicate with people who have this insanity? How can you negotiate with people who have this insanity? You cannot ever negotiate peace with Islam or with Muslims.
Yeah, that is exactly it. No, that is exactly the point, IQ, is that it's about impossible to deal with people that have no value of life whatsoever here. So, Ilana, as we talk about these 17 people, I want to ask you a specific question, please. These 17 people that are being accused of CIA-trained spies, do you think, I mean, will Iran go to the point of executing these people?
We'd like to underscore the fact that these are all Iranians. There are no Americans in this group. This is a group of Iranians who have been accused of spying for the CIA. And the fact that they specifically mentioned the CIA means they're trying to tie America into their own misdeeds. To answer your question, I have no doubt that they will execute these people, or as IQ says, they will murder them. Which is what it is. It's murder, because there probably is very little justification even for their arrest. But in the meantime, Iran's been doing this for a very, very long time. They take their own, they throw them into the most horrible prisons, they torture them, they abuse them in all kinds of ways, and then when it suits their need, they use them for propaganda and they murder them. Or they release them on very, very rare occasions. So yeah. I don't see anything good coming from this, but in the Iranian view of things, this is a very small issue.
So talk to us, Ilana, now about in the bigger picture of Iran, within the culture that Baruch had started talking about, and that IQ was on just a moment ago here, where we talk about this culture so people can understand that, you know, all bets are off when you're dealing with a country and you're dealing with those that play to Sharia law, like a country like Iran.
Well, when you're talking about Iran, Iran is unique because Iran is a Shia country. And it's governed by the super religious mullahs who are following the religious theology of the Shia form of Islam. They believe that the 12 imams who came after Muhammad, the final imam, was a person who didn't die but disappeared. And they call him the hidden imam. And he is the 12th imam, the one they believe who will come back as the Mahdi, their Messiah. And that he'll come back with Jesus to bring peace to the world and establish Islam as the ruling faith across the globe, because all the Christians who follow Jesus will announce that he is now a Muslim, and he will bring all of his Christians into Islam. So this is a kind of belief that they have wrapped their statecraft around. And so now what happens is you have a driving force behind these mullahs, which is to create a global caliphate, which will be under Shia rule, and that but one of the things they believe is that this will be preceded by global chaos. And I believe that there is a very strong possibility that all of these little things that we've been seeing in the Gulf, the capture or the attacks on ships, the bringing down the American drone, they're poking the tiger, or in this case, poking the eagle. They are trying to create, it seems to me, the beginnings of the chaos that will bring eventually the Mahdi to the world and create global peace and spread Islam, Shia Islam, all over the world. And if you can wrap your head around that, it's really hard to when you have a Western point of view, but if you can wrap your head around that, somehow all the things that are happening now begin to make sense. So when you hear that their own systems are breaking down, their army is restive, their people are very, very unhappy and starting to acting out against them, you begin to see that this fits into their plan. It's not that they're just not taking care of their people. They want people to, they want this chaos. And there is the possibility that they are trying to create the chaos that will bring the Mahdi. You know, when Ahmadinejad was president of Iran, he spoke at the United Nations. And he talked about the coming of the Mahdi. People were shocked when he did it in the United Nations. But he prayed in front of the General Assembly to hasten the emergence of the Mahdi. And when he was mayor of Tehran, he actually widened one of the main streets so that the Mahdi would have all the space he needed for his procession. So you're dealing with a kind of mindset that we are simply not familiar with. And the faster... we Americans have been doing this for a very, very long time. We have been projecting our own wants and hopes and fears and aspirations on everybody that we deal with. So we assume that the Iranians, and we assume that the anybody that we deal with actually in another part of the world wants a television in each room and wants money coming in the front door and wants beautiful clothes and wants whatever it is that Americans seem to want. And they assume that they do. And the reality is that they don't want this. Many, many people around the world want something totally different from what we want. And when we project this on them, then what we are doing is basically distancing ourselves from our objective, which is to help them and embrace them in whatever way we can. We can't do that if we assume that they want everything that we want. This is a false premise.
Yeah, very well said. And really, it is about, you're right, we often do project Western values onto too many. And I've said that before, but again, then it gets into nation building and you get into a lot of things. And this is one of the challenges America has, is to let people be who they are. You can't, not everybody is going to be a democracy or a republic. It's just not the way the world is. There are a lot of different cultures and a lot of different factions here at play here. Ilana has some very interesting points there, friends, that she puts out there. I'm curious as to what IQ will say about that in a moment here, when we talk to him in just a moment here. But, because really she talks about the culture and the fact of what I've been wondering and questioning, quite frankly, is what she talks about there. Why all of a sudden is Iran being so provocative and, as she said very well, poking the eagle, right? Poking the eagle, yeah. And very well said, because, you know, you see all of these things. And then with the British, you know, the British tankers, they took recently a couple of those. And you see the drones and, you know, all of this, a lot of stuff here playing with Iran. And it's not, in other words, it's not business as usual. There's something going on. And I've been suspect on this for a while. As to what's behind that. Now, Ilana puts out that she thinks there's something bigger from a religious standpoint that is behind that with the movement. I want to see what IQ and Baruch say about that in a moment. We'll continue on here with Ilana Friedman, IQ Al Razuli, and Baruch Blettner in just a moment.
Listen to Malcolm, the voice of a nation, on iHeartRadio or our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good-taste in gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company, Healthy Cell, will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud, or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com. Well, dealing with rogue governments, and when you say rogue governments, you can't finish that syllable when the first word that will come out of your mouth will be Iran for most people, because they certainly fit that description very well here. IQ, you hear before the pause, we were talking as Ilana went on and talked about the religious component of the Mahdi and what she thinks, what's playing out there in Iran, and maybe that's why they're doing some of the things they're doing in the Strait of Hormuz, and they're doing with some of the shooting down of the drone and some of these other things that are happening. Is that what is you feel? I want you to pick up on that. Is behind Iran, or is there something else going on there that we need to be aware of?
It is the religious part. It is the Shia Islam. It is the globalist idea of Shia Islam. They need to have total war, whereby the Mahdi will come and bring what they call peace. Peace, that means peace under Sharia Islam. In the latest talk shows that I've had recently, my host asked me to enumerate in descending order the greatest threat to the USA. Every time I asserted that first and foremost, the greatest threat in the 21st century to all non-Muslims, kuffar, infidels, comprising 80% of current humanity, of Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, atheists, etc., is Islam and Muslims. Because as far as every single Muslim on the planet is concerned, as commanded by the demonic God called Allah, is to either subjugate all non-Muslims to Sharia or exterminate them. As I said a few minutes earlier, how can any rational and sane human being negotiate with especially Iranian Muslims who gloat incessantly that we Muslims love death while you kuffar love life without weapons of mass destruction? Iran is the foremost country spreading terror all over the globe. They believe that the only way for the version of the Messiah called El Mahdi, meaning the righteous guide, to materialize is through Armageddon or total war. With atomic weapons, no one on earth will be safe, not even Sunni Muslims. The second threat will be to the USA, Europe, and Russia, and the Pacific nations will be China. But that's another story. As far as I'm concerned, Iran is number one threat to world peace.
Just let's step back a moment here. I want you to take a look ahead, please. If you were to predict, just let's take the next 10 years, just what do you think? Let's stay on Iran just a moment here. What happens in the next 10 years in regards to, back to Iran, and do you see a strike actually going to Israel? What do you see? What's your crystal ball say?
Well, my crystal ball would say that within a very short period of time, Israel will attack Iran. That's what it says.
Yeah, hold on now. Israel will attack Iran. Now, hold on. Is that before or after Iran attacks Israel?
Sorry. It's a preemptive attack. Israel will not wait for somebody to attack.
That's what I'm asking. Okay.
Forget it. It's preemptive. Israel cannot wait. They will not wait. And they're intelligent, and their intelligence is telling them Iran has weapons, but not yet small enough to put it on a missile. They have to attack her now, and they will attack her.
Let me ask you this, IQ. When that happens, okay, the damage that is then done to Iran, how serious is that specifically, and what does Iran look like after that point?
Well, let's get this in context. They will attack the military installations that could create atomic weapons. And by the way, with modern technology, let me explain something to the Americans. You can shoot a cruise missile to 1 by 1 square meter, and you follow it by another one, and the third one, and the fourth one. Each one of them is a cluster bomb. It destroys installations which are made in concrete. So the first bomb goes in, blows up. The next one goes after it, goes further down. And the third one goes even further down. And the fourth one will completely obliterate the other one. So the objective, even without atomic weapons, tactical or otherwise, they can use specialized bombs with cruise missiles to destroy the installations of the aliens.
So if that happens, what is Iran specifically? How do they move forward as a country after that happens?
Well, it's not a catastrophe. They are destroying their military installations. Iran continues.
So is this the end of Iran at that point?
Well, it will be the end of the mullahs. Let's put it this way in context. Iran will not be destroyed. It's 80 million people, 800,000 square miles, I think. Maybe 1 million square miles.
Okay.
What I'm getting at, they will destroy the infrastructure, the military infrastructure of the Iranians. Okay. Whereby it is most probable the Iranian people will take up arms and will destroy the mullahs.
I see.
Ilana is right. Baruch is right. They have their back to the wall. Mm-hmm. They know if the Iranian people take over, not a single mullah will survive. Not one.
All right.
All the mullahs in Iran will be slaughtered.
Interesting. All right, let's get over to Baruch now and bring Baruch, you back in here, please. So the question is, if they attack first, I'd like you to bring that forward. Do you agree with everything IQ puts out there? Is this a change in moment for the country of Iran?
Well, I think there is a tremendous, tremendous reluctance in Israel to strike Iran. We know that Netanyahu in years back either actually commanded or came very, very close to commanding or ordering such a strike, mm-hmm. and was kind of rebuffed by the military brass, and it's either was insubordination or something quite close to that. So my natural tendency is to think that Israel would be very, very reluctant to do it. But there is a but to that story, and that is that from what I'm seeing recently in Israel, there are very, very serious preparations being made to take out the Hamas in the south and the Hezbollah in the north, but I mean take out their entire tens and hundreds of thousands of missiles that are aimed at Israel, and decisively win this time the engagements against them. And one thing that should be understood is that cannot be done independent of Iran. You cannot do that without engaging Iran. So that's why I'm thinking that maybe what IQ is saying is actually correct. In other words, that Israel may go in this kind of three-front approach, Iran, but simultaneously Hamas and Hezbollah, because that's the only way it can really work. If Israel just attacks Iran, there's no question that all these missiles and rockets that Hezbollah and Hamas have now will be fired at Israel. So Israel has to preemptively strike not only Iran, but also the Gaza Strip and South Lebanon, or actually pretty much all of Lebanon.
Yeah.
It's a very, very major undertaking. It's honestly, the repercussions of that are kind of difficult to imagine.
Right.
But at the same time, it is looking almost inevitable at this point.
Right, right. Well, all right. So it plays to the fact I asked you all earlier, do they have a nuclear weapon now? And you all said they probably do. And then we're getting closer and closer to this moment of truth then. Here's what I want to ask you now, Baruch. If that happens, everything we just laid out, the way that plays out, and as you say now, it's a 1-2-3-4 approach to what happens. There's going to be multiple fronts on this war. And if that plays out that way, what does Russia and China do?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because it plays into this whole issue of globalism, and the main people that play in that globalist arena, which is strangely enough, the European Union, China, and the American globalists, in other words, the Democrats and some significant parts of the Republicans as well, that are, you know, like let's say the Bushes and the Romneys of this world.
Yes, sir.
And Russia is a nationalistic country on one hand. On the other hand, it's also very closely aligned with China and Iran. So it's a difficult puzzle to solve here. I think that when it comes to globalists, you know, Ilana was speaking correctly about this issue of chaos, and people often ask. Why the globalists, whose social agenda on social issues is so much at odds with the, you know, Iranian one, with the Muslim, especially Shia Muslim one, you know, with regards to gay rights and women's rights and all that kind of stuff, why are they aligned together? And I think that the reason is that they are aligned together is because both of them want chaos. Globalism can only win if there is chaos in the world. If people become so kind of disturbed, in even kind of deranged. In other words, they can't make a living. They can't find their way in the world. They can't succeed as individuals. Mm-hmm. They become vulnerable and they fall prey to all these isms, you know, to communism and socialism and globalism, which are kind of all the same kind of thing, where basically you surrender your individual rights to this all-powerful government. And so chaos is the one common objective to Iran and to the globalists. But when it comes to China and Russia, I think they actually may want more world order, because both of them need to export their goods. In case of Russia, it's primarily oil and related products. In case of China, it's all those manufactured goods. So my guess is, to answer your question directly, is that both China and Russia will actually act to limit the conflict rather than to pour gasoline on it, because neither one of them can survive in a world in which their exports are valueless and the monetary system is completely disturbed. And they, you know, especially the Chinese have to feed, what is it now, 1.2, 1.3 billion people. They cannot do that without major, major influx of foreign currencies from the sale of their manufactured goods. And Russia itself is in very poor political shape right now. There's demonstrations and all that. So I think they will actually, maybe perversely to what we would think, act as a force of as a stabilizing force, mm-hmm, rather than a destabilizing one.
So what you're saying there is cooler heads would prevail then, Baruch, is what you're saying, and that in that we would fall short of a World War III at that point then.
I would want to think so, because I would want to think that survival to people who are now are heading up China and Russia, it's not the same as the mullahs. They don't have this eschatological end of days calculus. Mm. They want to live just like everybody else wants to live. They want their countries to be powerful and successful. And I don't think that they can do that, or that they believe that they can do that, in a world that is ruled by chaos, in which, again, there is no possibility of exchanging money across borders, and the monetary systems collapse and that kind of stuff. I don't think that they would want that. So I think that there would be stronger forces to limit the conflict than those forces that would want to, further internationalize it. So that's at least would be my prediction and my hope, yes.
Yeah, very good. Wow. Boy, I'll tell you what, it is a thought-provoking conversation. IQ, with what Baruch says there, as far as, you know, speaking about China and Russia, knowing that, you know, this is, there's an end game here. Do you agree with that statement? Do they stay out of it, or do they, do you agree with that?
100%. Okay. I'll tell you something else. Okay. Both Russia and China are suffering from Muslims. Both Russia and China have a huge number of Muslims. Tens of millions, maybe 20, 30, 40 million Muslims who are themselves undermining these countries. I agree with Baruch. Yes, okay. 100%. Why should they interfere? Why should anybody interfere? Why? There is no country on earth is threatened more by Iran than Israel. No country on earth is threatened. Okay, yeah. So the United States.
Yeah.
But provoking the United States is so stupid. The Iranians are looking for trouble, they will get it. And they will deserve it. Honestly, nobody will deserve it more than the Iranian rulers. Mm-hmm. I agree with Baruch. I agree with Ilana. We are on the same wavelength. You know what? Donald Trump should have us as advisors, honestly.
There you go. There you go. There's an opportunity. We'll put that out there. Hey, Ilana, let's pick up there now where IQ was and Baruch was a moment, please. And I'm learning a few things here. I think people are right now with this whole the juxtaposition of what we've talked about now that Baruch puts out there, and actually that IQ started in regards to the attack against Israel, a preemptive attack, not waiting for Iran to do that. What do you think about that point, Ilana? Because we have not talked about that yet. What's your thoughts on that?
I'd like to go back to the question about Russia, because we saw something in Syria that may help us to understand what's likely to happen in Iran. When Israel saw that Iran was pushing its operations closer and closer to the Israeli border, and also knew that Russian planes were patrolling the Syrian airspace, as a matter of fact, the Prime Minister Netanyahu flew to Moscow to have direct talks with Putin. And what they came up with was that as long as the strikes that Israel made in Syria to keep Iran at bay were only on nuclear targets, they would not interfere. This fell apart somewhat when, as a direct result of one of the Israeli attacks, a Russian plane was hit and a number of Russian soldiers were killed. And that sort of threw a monkey wrench into this agreement. But nevertheless, the agreement itself is something that has a precedent. So I would suggest that there is a good possibility that Russia would allow Israel to come in and attack Iranian military facilities, and particularly nuclear facilities, without interfering, as long as Russian interests were not in any way threatened. So that would be the first part of my answer relating to, would Russia interfere? No, I don't think they would. I think they would allow Israel to do whatever Israel feels it is necessary to do within the confines of an agreement between Russia and Israel. So that would be one thing. As far as a preemptive strike, I think we are coming to a point where that may be almost academic, except from the point of view of the world view of it. The world will not see what's going on the ground. They will not see the Iranian preparations. They will not see the threat that Iran poses to Israel. And remember, Israel is a tiny little country. It's about the size of Vermont. And you see Israel taking on Iran, and it's a huge country. And Israel taking it on seems to be something quite unbelievable. But they are capable of doing it, and they are capable of succeeding. The question is whether they will do it preemptively or not, or whether they are able to actually wait until Iran poses a direct threat and the world is able to perceive it. Those are two different questions. And then you have something else going on, which is that Hamas and Hezbollah have made an agreement that if one is attacked, the other one will start an action. so that Israel will already immediately be fighting on two fronts. And it's actually three fronts because Hezbollah is active both in Lebanon and Syria. And Hamas, of course, is active in Gaza. So this puts Israel in a very, very precarious situation. One, I think it is absolutely aware of. And I believe Israel will take the necessary steps to do whatever is necessary, including the possibility of a preemptive strike, if they feel that it is necessary.
So the status quo where we're at right now, where it's been business as usual or politics as usual, Ilana, it sounds to me, in listening to you and listening to Baruch and IQ, that what everybody should probably pull from it is I think things are going to change. I think we're feeling or sensing that we're at an interesting time is what I'm suggesting to you all. And you know, something's going to change here ahead. It's not going to stay the way it is, I think. I think you can really feel that because as you see the factors of what we've talked about and the ramifications of this are significant. So there's a lot more we need to do in talking about rogue governments and rogue organizations. And we've got to move this conversation off now. It's funny how Iran has taken center stage of this. But again, as was pointed out of the program here, they are center to most of the world terror. And a lot of it comes from that ideology, people here. So we'll continue on here with this conversation in just a moment. Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Now, I want to talk about Africa a moment, Baruch, and I'd like to bring it right to you, if I might, please. In a previous program we did some weeks ago, which was quite a program, actually, you mentioned, if I recall correctly, you said it was probably the biggest concern you had in the world. Mm-hmm. You were worried about some of these, specifically, rogue governments in Africa, the continent of it. Can you speak to that point? And can you give us a sense of what's really going on there, please?
Well, I mean, the reason that I think that Africa is kind of long-term strategically the biggest threat to world stability is that it just seems so, the problems that it poses seem so intractable. I know that we're focused on, you know, for example, we discussed previously Iran and so on. But the problem with Iran is substantially its regime. I don't believe that the Iranian people as such pose a problem. I think it's the regime that sold them on a bunch of goods with respect to this eschatological worldview is the problem. And in some, to some not insignificant degree, the West itself, because the West now is so decadent and so morally corrupt that it is easy to, it's very easy to tell people like Iranians or people of that in other nations, look at the West. Yes, they have their Lexuses and their manicured lawns, but the price they pay for that is total moral depravity, and that's not a price worth paying. Now, of course, we know that that's not true. You can have a financial and economic prosperity and be morally upright, and America has been that, and the West has been that for many years, for most of its life, even though now it's not like that. But it's a point that a lot of people in the world believe, and they look at this and they say, well, we don't want that. Even if we will live better financially, we don't want that moral decay. Nevertheless, though, I think that you can kind of wrap your arms around the problems of Iran, of North Korea, of Russia and China. But when it comes to Africa, you have a continent, and I don't know, like, what is it now, a billion people or so, and they are procreating at to totally unsustainable rates. They kind of absorbed enough of Western medicine and hygiene to, you know, to help with their birth rates and with kids staying alive rather than dying like they used to before all of that Western medicine came along. But at the same time, they haven't really modernized. So they don't have a situation where they have two or three children who survive. You know, they a family has two or three children and then they survive into adult. No, they have 15 children and 10 children. It's proven impervious, totally impervious to any kind of progress in, you know, and I'm talking about sub-Saharan Africa substantially. So when I look at that continent with its unsustainable growth rates, population growth rates, with its total lack of productivity, of contribution along the lines of technology or anything else that's valued in the world today, I have to ask myself, you know, what is the solution? I mean, we know that they're not going to just sit there and die of starvation. They're going to just leave. They're going to flood the world with these masses of refugees, of migrants, or whatever you want to call them. And right now the world is trying to pay them off substantially by basically feeding them like animals in a zoo. But that's not a sustainable strategy, considering their growth rate again. And so I really don't know. I don't know what the solution to this problem is. All I know is that Africa is just getting poorer, more densely populated, less able to feed its own population. It is the hotbed of everything that's bad. You start with epidemics, with diseases, with violence, specifically violence against women and children, with tribal violence, a multitude of genocides that they perpetrate mostly against each other, but also against whites, for example, now in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And corruption. I mean, corruption in Africa is unprecedented even in our very corrupt world. So, you know, it's one of those things that I look at that and I say, you know what, I don't know. I don't know what can possibly solve that problem. That's mm-hmm. why I think it's the biggest challenge.
It's an unknown. There's a lot of unknowns there is what you're saying. And I totally agree with you. There are a lot of unknowns. It's not a direct regime, as you say, like in Iran, where you know what you're kind of dealing with. The problem with a lot of what you're speaking about right now is that we just don't know. There are far more unknowns than there are knowns. And here's the other problem. A lot of the vacuum that you're mentioning that we're talking about in these Africa countries right now, I think that that is being sucked up by jihadists. I think they're moving in. Yeah. That's what worries me the most, Baruch, is they're moving in. Yeah. And they're taking over these environments and making them even more hostile. And we're seeing that right across the board here. IQ, let's speak to that, please. I want your expertise talking about what Baruch says there about Africa. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, he would have been called a racist and other names in the United States of America today if he was on a television show or radio talk show. What he was telling the truth, like we do all the time. Uh-huh. We discuss facts and reality.
Yeah.
Africa is corrupt. Africa is unable to produce. People forget something very elementary. There was never in Africa a civilization, except in North Africa, which is not Africa actually, was the Egyptian pharaonic. Otherwise, there was never a history of civilization in Africa. You cannot name a single African that I know of who has contributed anything to the advancement and or betterment of humanity in any way, shape, or form. This is not an insult, this is a fact.
Well, hold on now. Hold on. I'm going to test you there. What about Barack Obama? He was born out there, wasn't he?
But Barack Obama, everybody forgets, he's not a bloody African. He's a mulatto. A mulatto is half-breed. Why? They forget about his half-white. Forget about it. Baruch said he can't figure. As far as I'm concerned, with Islam and Africa, you have to quarantine them. Quarantine means you don't allow anybody coming into Europe or America.
Wow.
Listen. We are talking about draconian issues. What Islam is doing is not, they're not immigrants. It's an invasion. It is an invasion. It is mandated in the Quran that when you all go to a foreign country, a non-European, non-Muslim country, it's called Dar al-Harb. Dar al-Harb means the territory of war. Why would a Muslim leave the territory of Islam, which is called Dar al-Islam or Dar al-Salam, or means the territory of peace, to go to the land of the infidels? They don't come into the land of the infidels to integrate or assimilate. They are coming to bring Sharia. Let's get it through the thick heads of everybody. Mm-hmm. One single purpose in the life of a Muslim is to bring Sharia to dominate the whole of humanity. Simple, not complicated. Anybody who wants to argue with me, please do so. You know, anybody. So far, in 12 years, I've not had a single imam or mullah or scholar of Islam or anybody debate me. It's a simple subject.
You know, the common denominator of all the things we're talking about that IQ you're putting out there, and certainly Ilana Baruch is that this is a fight of good versus evil. We talk about good and evil, but this is center to that whole conversation and dialogue that we speak about. Ilana, I'd like to pick up a moment with you, and we cannot not talk about North Korea a moment here. And we've seen the latest, this rebellious little child there, Kim Jong-un, and you talk about oppression and what he's done to the North Korean people. By golly, he has changed. He has changed that country forever. Him and his family, his father and his grandfather, for that matter. Talk about a bad pool of genes. That would be it right there. So North Korea now. How does Donald Trump continue to handle North Korea? I mean, he. A lot of times you think you got the guy figured out. Now, the problem with him is he's got nuclear possession. He can do some things. And he's testing out these warheads. What do you think?
It's not certain why he is testing out the warheads. What is it he is trying to say is still in a bit of a cloud. He's a puzzle because he has an agenda that we do not understand. He has kept his people in poverty, in starvation, for the short term that he has been the head of this country, but his father and his grandfather did it before him. North Korea has been in terrible shape for a very, very long time. The people have been suffering. You know, when I talked before about the nuclear development that was going on there and the location of their test site, this was all built with North Korean slave labor. If you don't agree with your great leader, you go to these camps and you work till you die. It's a terrible, terrible place, and yet he's living the life of Riley. He's comfortable, he's fat, he's happy, I guess, but as I said before, he has many masters. So I'm not sure exactly what his motivation is for these new missiles, but I assume he's taking his instructions from somewhere other than Donald Trump. And I think the president needs to be very cognizant of the fact that he has probably taken his strategy of good fellow, well met, to Kim Jong-un about as far as he can take it now. And now he's used the carrot, now he's got to use the whip.
Had the American media and the fascist Democrats not been so utterly insane in their opposition to Trump, he would have had much better results with his opposition to Kim Jong-un. The fact that Trump is so vilified and opposed to every achievement and act allows Kim to believe that Trump is only temporary and will be out in 2020 with a much less aggressive and even maybe a servile president who will take over. The fault is not with Trump, believe me. Irana, you're right. The fault is with his opponents.
Yeah, no, I mean, we agree.
Maybe Trump would do well if he talked to Japan about not being so trigger happy against any kind of peace or rapprochement or any kind of deal between South and North Korea, because Koreans are very proud people. I've dealt with them quite often in business in my previous life, as well as in Japan, where I've been hundreds of times. And there is a tremendous amount of bad blood since Japan occupied Korea for more than 20 years and exceedingly brutally, as we all know. There is a tremendous amount of bad blood there. And I know that Japan is a very close ally of the U.S., maybe closer in some sense than South Korea. But I think that a good way to deal with this, and I agree with Ilana that this whole, you know, friendship thing, you know, this let's get together and have a Coke thing, that's outlived its usefulness at this point. It had some usefulness in the past, but now I think Trump would be well advised to give some, to ask Japan to give some room to the two Korea, to the two Koreas, to kind of see if they can, between the two of them, figure out what they want to do on that peninsula, which is their peninsula. It's their home. They're the same people. They speak the same language. They have the same shared history, good and bad. And really, I think it would be the best thing to get the two of them to figure it out together, even if it's not always in the way that, you know, the United States would want.
The bigger challenge with what we talk about here today with you all is it's not just the fact that we are fighting these rogue governments, these rogue states, if you will, and that we have to be concerned. Again, the problem is that the United States has to be right 100% of the time, whereas any of these rogue governments and states we're talking about don't have to be. They just have to be right once, and then we've got a problem on our hands. That's number one. The next thing, people, is that, as IQ has pointed out and very well, and Baruch and Ilana have second, is the fact that we have the forces in this country, that in America, that are fighting against the West, that are fighting against Trump, and as Baruch said, the big peoples, the Romneys, the Bushes, even on the Republican side, as far as the Democrat side, he's right. You've got a lot of these. Well, the denominator of all that, use the word globalist when we say that. These are globalist-minded people. They think it's all, the world is a kumbaya kind of place, and everybody's going to hold hands and whistle Dixie. Yeah, we're all going to go off in the sunset somewhere. We all know that's a fairy tale that is not accurate. There's a lot of volatility on planet Earth. It is, you know, it's a planet that we populate here in the, as I say all the time, in the universe of universes. It's a blessing we are here through God Almighty, and that we have this amazing, magnificent planet to be on. And yet we lose sight of that often. And again, man's worst enemy is man. I mean, we are our own enemy, and you can bring that denominator all the way back to the United States. Our enemy here is our own. It's from within. And the fact that foreign governments and foreign adversaries and rogue governments and these states, they use politics here to fight against all of us, because they use the left and the right, and they see what's going on here. They see the unbalancedness here in America. They see these puppets and what they're doing to this country. And they see what's happening here, and they use that sadly against us. What that means, people, is we are our own enemy. We have been. I've said that from moment one to you. I continue to say it today. So as we talk about dealing with these rogue enterprises here and these rogue states around the world, the most important thing, please, is that we not be ignorant, please. The best public is an informed public. It's most important that we, the people, is informed. What a pleasure, and a big thank you to Ilana, IQ, and Baruch for joining us here on The Voice of a Nation, friends. The rallying call is simple. It's time to get involved and get loud.